what is true power, what is authentic power. There was a book I read by a man named Gary Zukav called Seat of the Soul. And in Seat of the Soul, definition of authentic power, meaning the kind of power that can never be taken from you, not your looks, not your fame, not your money, not your square footage, but authentic power is when the personality, your personality, comes to serve the energy of your soul. When you are able to align who you are, who you've become in the world, with really what you've come to do in the world, when your personality serves the soul. So I thought a lot about that. That book was actually life-changing for me. And I was building a home in Santa Barbara. And as anybody who's ever built a bathroom or a home or anything, nothing ever happens on time. And it was 2002 and we're supposed to be finished and it wasn't finished. And I was like, I can't wait to get in my house and I'm finally going to have a great Christmas and I'm going to do the kind of Christmas that I dreamed of from the Courier and Ives, you know, card. So I'm going to have the wreaths on the door. But I didn't have a floor, so it's a little difficult to do that. So I started to think, if I can't do that Christmas, well, what am I going to do for Christmas? My house isn't even ready, and what can I do? So I started, as I was walking around through the trees, sitting under that tree, because my favorite time is to be alone with my thoughts. And as I was alone with my thoughts, I was thinking, what would be the next best possible Christmas for myself? And I thought of the best Christmas I ever had. The best Christmas I ever had was when I was 12 years old. My mother was on welfare. I was living with my mother and a half brother and sister in Milwaukee. And my mother called me, the oldest, to say, into a room to say, we won't be having Christmas this year. I said, we won't be having Christmas. What about Santa Claus? There is no Santa Claus. I had already figured that out, but okay. I was embarrassed and I was ashamed because for the first time, I had to face the reality that, yeah, what I've been suspecting, that we're not like the other kids, that we really are poor, is true. So we're not gonna have Christmas and there is no Santa Claus. My first thought after being embarrassed and ashamed was, what will my story be? What am I gonna tell everybody when we go back to school and they're showing their toys and I don't have anything to talk about? What am I gonna do? I'm not gonna go outside tomorrow when everybody's out in the yards, in their yards, showing the toys they got for Christmas. I'm gonna stay inside. Am I gonna pretend I'm sick? What is my story going to be? Well, late that night, some nuns showed up at our house and they brought a basket of food and they brought toys for my brother and my sister. And I was overwhelmed with joy. Those nuns showed up. Not because they brought me a Tammy doll when I really wanted a Barbie doll. I was overwhelmed because somebody remembered that we existed and somebody cared enough in the middle of the night to come to our house with food and toys. And also, I would now have a story. So as I was contemplating, that was the best Christmas I ever had. I thought, how could I make that possible for somebody else? What could I do to create the same kind of experience for other children? So I took 50 members of my team at Harpo, Harriet, one of them, Sherry, the table, and hired another 50 people in South Africa. And we went to South Africa with the idea of creating something that we ended up doing a documentary about called Christmas Kindness. Christmas Kindness, using my personality to serve the energy of my soul. So we went from village to village, offering toys and clothes, food, soccer balls to children who'd never experienced Christmas before. And early in the morning, you could see them lining up by the thousands to come. And we actually went to 10 or 12 villages to do this. And people said to me at the time, oh, that's so frivolous and the kids won't remember it. And why don't you use your money to do something else more substantial, Oprah? And I said, they may not remember the toy. They may not remember the clothes, although they were most excited, the children, to open boxes containing clothes because, as their caretaker said to us, having new clothes made them not feel poor. And for so many of these kids, it was the first time they'd ever experienced having something that was new for them. They may not remember what they got in the box, but they will remember that somebody remembered them. They will remember the experience. So during this entire experience, Nelson Mandela had invited Stedman and I to stay at his home. So when Nelson Mandela invites you, you stay. And I was so nervous. I was like, oh my God, what am I gonna talk to? Because it's 10 days. It's 10 days. It's not just a dinner. It's not a lunch. It's 10 days. It's 10 days, breakfast, lunch, and dinner with Nelson Mandela. What am I gonna say? Stedman said, why don't you try listening? So I did. I had 29 meals with Nelson Mandela. At first, really, I was very, like, oh my God, it's Nelson Mandela. And by the third or fourth day, he and I would sit together in his living room, sharing the paper at the end of the day, talking about events in the world. And one of the things we came to talk about the most was the power of education to overcome poverty. So in one of those lucid moments, I said to him, well, I've always wanted to build a school. He said, you want to build a school? Oprah, you want to build a school? So he got up and made a phone call to the Minister of Education. I wasn't planning on building it then, but all right. The Minister of Education comes over later in the day and we start the process of building a school. The reason why I wanted to build a school, because I tried different things, because I always knew, even before I could articulate, that my personality needs to serve my soul.
So I want to talk to you about walking down another street. And this other street is a street in which you have an awareness that not only do you have a physical body, but you have come to believe that this physical body is who you are, and that you have locked yourself into these five senses and decided that whatever evidence they provide for you is how you identify and define your reality. By what I see, by what I hear, by what I smell, by what my life looks like, by how much money I have, by the stuff that I possess. And this is the world of the ego, and this is the world of the false self. The false self is the ego. The ego is the part of us that has come to believe that who I am is defined by these six things. Who I am is what I have. And so we spend a big hunk of our life attempting to get as much stuff as we possibly can. The Tao teaches something very different. Let go of everything you have. When I moved to Maui in 2005 full time, I gave up everything that I owned. Everything. 20,000 books, all of my photographs, records of every description, furniture, all the things in the house. All my clothing, shoes, it was all donated to people who lived on the underneath a bypass in Florida. And let go of all of it. So the ego teaches us you are what you have. The Tao teaches us let go of everything that you have. Do less and accomplish more. One of Lao Tzu's most famous observations was, I do nothing and leave nothing undone. My son has taken to becoming a spiritual Taoist. Every time I tell him to do something, he says, I do nothing and I leave nothing undone. But there's much wisdom in that. I could go on into that. The second thing that the ego teaches us is that who I am is not only what I have, but who I am is what I do, what I accomplish. And so we spend a big hunk of our lives believing that the way that we become, quote, successful, happy, fulfilled, self-actualized, whatever it might be, is on the basis of what I accomplish, what my resume looks like, how many promotions I get. And so we send our children off to school and we ask them to learn to identify themselves on how much they get and what they accomplish. Your grades become more important than what it is that you are studying. What you own, what clothes you wear, what labels you have, and so on. And we become obsessed with this kind of absurdity. And this is the false self at work. The third thing that the ego teaches us is that I am what other people think of me. I am my reputation. So becoming obsessed with our reviews, what people think of us, other people's opinions, getting the approval of others. We talk about peer group approval needs and so on. I have 8 children that aren't concerned about those things. They were never raised with that kind of a mentality. The whole idea of, you know, trying to please other people was something that they consistently heard from their mother and myself, that this isn't important to us. We don't, we're not attached to that. And this kind of an attachment. So the Tao teaches us that what you think of me is none of my business. What the ego teaches us is that what you think of me is the most important thing that I have, and so I'll do whatever it is that I need to do in order to get you to agree with me, to like me, to approve of me, and so on. The fourth thing that the ego teaches us, this false self, is that who I am is separate from everyone else. And so we are raised in this world of the false self, which teaches us that we have to be in competition with everyone else. We have to defeat someone else. Being number one is the most important thing. And you see people doing this all the time at football games and at badminton. You'll see it when the Olympics come up, you know, that the gold medal is more important than anything else. And if I don't, you'll see people weeping and sobbing over this idea that I have to be better than somebody else in order to be fulfilled in my life. The fifth thing that the ego teaches us is that I am separate not only from everybody else, but that I am separate from what's missing in my life. The Tao teaches us that there is no place that God is not. If there is no place that God is not, then God must be in you. And if there is no place that God is not, then God must also be in all that I perceive to be missing from my life. And therefore, in order to become a manifester and to attract into my life what I want, I simply have to realign myself. I have to rejoin. I have to yoga myself to God. And the most egregious error of the ego is a belief system that says that who I am is separate from God, that God is something outside of me. We have not been raised to understand and believe that at our basic core, what Lao Tzu called our original nature, what we are is love. And all we have to do is be that and live that. There was a great Indian poet. His name was Rabindranath Tagore. And he received the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1913 for a collection of poetry called the Gitanjali. And in that poem, that long poem, 90 some verses, one of those verses says this. He's speaking of the ego. He said, I went out alone on my way to my tryst. But who is this me in the dark? I step aside to avoid his presence, but I escape him not. He makes the dust rise from the earth with his swagger. He adds his loud voice to every word I utter. He is my own little self, my Lord. He knows no shame, but I am ashamed to come to thy door in his company. That's a great poet, and that's a great piece of truth, that in order to get to this place I speak about, that Maslow spoke to me about and trained me to think about, called self-actualization, is that we have to stop evaluating who we are on the basis of those ego identifiers, and instead begin to see ourselves as divine love.
Your physical body is not physical. Your material body is not material. You have to start thinking of your body as an activity, as a process, if I may say so, instead of a noun, as a verb, an activity. So our bodies are constantly in the river of change and transformation. The Greek philosopher Heraclitus said, no man can step into the same river twice, because it's a new man and it's a new river. Likewise, your true self cannot step into the same flesh and bones twice, because in every moment of your life, you're actually in the river of change, which is your physical body. Through processes like eating, breathing, digestion, metabolism, illumination, sensory experience, thoughts, feelings, emotions, desires, memories, imagination, creativity, intention, intuition, inspiration, your body is in transformation. In fact, the physical bodies that you're using right now to listen to my lecture are not the ones that you came in from Times Square a few minutes ago. Even with one breath that you breathe in 10 to the power of 22 atoms, which is a huge amount of stuff that comes from everywhere. Your environment ends up as your cells, your heart, your brain, your kidneys. With every breath that you breathe out, you're literally breathing out at the atomic level, bits and pieces of your heart and kidney and brain tissue. And technically speaking, we're all intimately sharing our organs with each other right this moment. In fact, there are studies, mathematical calculations, that can show you without a shadow of doubt that right this moment, you might have a million atoms that were once in the body of Jesus Christ or Buddha or Genghis Khan or anyone else you want to think about. In just the last 3 weeks, a quadrillion atoms have gone through your body that have gone through the body of every other living species on this planet. So think of a tree in Africa, a squirrel in Siberia, a peasant in China. You have stuff in your body, which is actually non-stuff, that was there only 3 weeks ago. None of the atoms in your body are the ones that you were born with. None. They were manufactured in the crucible of stars, and in fact, the atoms in this hand and the atoms here may have come from different stars. The carbon, the hydrogen, the oxygen that is right now circulating in your body is not even a material entity, it's a process. Once you understand that your body is a process, then you can engage in reinventing the body. And you do so by very simple, fundamental activities that you pay attention to. So let me tell you what are the most important fundamental activities. Sleep. When you sleep, your body rejuvenates itself, repairs itself. Not only your brain, but the rest of your body. The second thing, meditation. We now have actually scientific proof that a daily practice of meditation, and we have done these studies with places like scientists at Harvard, at Mount Sinai here in New York, and University of California, within 4 days of meditation, people increased the enzyme that controls biological age by almost 40% in 4 days. And then we took those samples, we sent them to our teams, as I said, in these institutions, and we showed that the entire genome starts to express itself in a different way. You don't change the sequence of nucleotides in your body, but there are genes that get upregulated, genes that promote homeostasis or self-regulation or self-repair, and there are genes that get down-regulated, genes that activate inflammation. So both inflammation and homeostasis or self-repair are protective mechanisms. When you fall down, you need the inflammatory response to heal yourself. But if that response is exaggerated, then it is the basis of many diseases, including chronic conditions like bronchial asthma, arthritis, many types of cancer, etc., etc., heart disease, inflammatory disorders are all connected with these diseases. So when the genes get down-regulated for inflammation, the genes get upregulated, you're literally changing the activity of your genes and the enzymes that control cellular aging. And this we have shown already. So here are the few things that really matter. I mentioned sleep, meditation, movement. The more you move, the healthier your body. Don't worry about the kind of exercise you want to do. You can do any exercise. The key thing is to keep moving. The fourth thing is emotional well-being. And somebody in a previous talk mentioned the limbic brain. The limbic brain is that part of your brain that is influenced by your emotions. So when you experience emotions like joy, peace, compassion, empathy, then there's a phenomenon that occurs in your brain. It's called limbic resonance. And the hormones that are secreted and the neuropeptides that are secreted, like oxytocin and dopamine and serotonin and opiates, these are immunomodulators and they enhance self-healing or self-repair. On the other hand, if you're feeling guilt, hostility, depression, and any of the things that create fear in your body, then limbic resonance turns to limbic dissonance, and that starts a disruption of homeostasis. So cultivating those emotions. And finally, diet. A diet that is free of a diet that's not based on refined foods, manufactured foods, or processed foods. A diet that is more plant-based, and also perhaps a Mediterranean diet, which includes fish and olive oil. It's that simple. Sleep, meditation, movement, cultivating healthy emotions, and a healthy diet. So here's the formula. Wake up every day with the intention that you're going to experience a joyful, energetic body, a restful, alert mind. Cultivate the emotions of peace, joy, love, compassion, empathy, and equanimity. And finally, experience lightness of soul, because at the core of our being is an intelligence that's orchestrating all these activities that I mentioned. You have 600 trillion cells in your body, which is more than all the stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Only, by the way, only 10% of them are human. The rest is what is called the microbiome. So of the 600 trillion cells in your body, most of them are bacteria. You're a walking bacterial colony with a few human cells added. And all of these cells are working together as an ecosystem. And the things I mentioned to you, they influence everything. Diet particularly influences the microbiome, which is in our GI tract. And the microbiome and your genes actually regulate each other. So it's a fascinating thing. Our body is star stuff that has learned to self-regulate itself, that has become self-aware, that knows itself, that regulates itself, that evolves, and ultimately that goes back to the field of pure consciousness, which is a field of infinite possibilities, infinite creativity, that takes leaps of evolution. And as we move into the future, I think you'll see that reinventing the body is not a possibility in the future, it's a possibility right now.
Life has no agenda. It's for you to be a full-fledged life. A grasshopper is trying to be a full-fledged grasshopper. Earthworm is trying to be a full-fledged earthworm. A bird is trying to be a full-fledged bird. A tree is trying to be a full-fledged tree. A human being should strive to become a full-fledged human being. These are all our businesses. But each one of us start creating our own agenda and doing all kinds of things. No, no, you're just a piece of life. Don't take yourself too seriously. Because before you and me, countless number of people have come and gone. Yes or no? Where are they? All those people. You think they were all idiots? They were all idiots and they died, is it? No, they were also like you, maybe they were also officers, maybe they were kings more than you, all kinds of things, all topsoil now. This will also become topsoil. Just a little bit of time. Life is a bit of a sparkle. How old is your son, sir? 25. So 27 years ago, where was he, sir? So if somebody is not here, we say they are dead, isn't it? 27 years ago, he was dead. We will give him 100 years, sir. 80 years later, he will be again dead. Yes or no? So 27 years ago, how long was he dead, sir? Long time. So 85 years later or 80 years later, how long will he be dead, sir? Very long time. So all of us will be dead for a very long time. We're alive just for a brief amount of time. Yes? Very brief amount of time. we will be dead for a very long time. I want you to look at it in this perspective. How long will you be dead? You can't imagine. So let us say 10,000 years we are dead, or 100,000 years we are dead, or 1,000,000 years we are dead, all right? How long are you alive compared to that? Very, very brief. What you call as life is a brief sparkle. The only thing that you have to do is rise and sparkle as a full-fledged life. When something is needed around us, we will do that naturally, because when you're doing wonderfully well, you will do what is needed, isn't it? When you're miserable, you will be motivated. Tell me, when you're very happy, have you looked at yourself? How nice and wonderful you are, you're willing to do anything for anybody, you bend backwards if necessary, yes or no? When you're little frustrated, how difficult it is. So, don't teach your children to become motivated about something. These are all nonsense that's coming from the West, all those trashy self-help books. Motivate yourself, build confidence, believe in yourself. You believed in God and destroyed so much of this world. Now you believe in yourself, what will you do? All this trash is coming from the West. You don't have to be motivated. You just have to see how this is alive to its fullest possible level right now. If it's fully alive, it will do everything that it can do, isn't it? What it cannot do, anyway it will not do. If you watch a bird in the morning it's doing everything that it can do, isn't it? Everything that it can do, it'll spare nothing. That's all you have to do. Everything that you can do. What you cannot do? Perfectly okay. A worm cannot do what a bird does. A bird cannot do what an elephant does. An elephant cannot do what we do. Yes or no? But we must be doing what we can do. What we cannot do, it doesn't matter. What we can do must happen. For this, all that's needed is, you must understand life is a very brief sparkle. It's just poop, poop, poop and gone. Yes or no? Before you know what's happening, you'll be gone. Unless you're miserable. Miserable people have a long life. Only they feel life is long. If you're very joyful, poof, it'll be gone before you know what's happening. Have you noticed a specific day? You're very happy. 24 hours, gone like that. Little miserable. 24 hours, feel like 10,000 years. Yes or no? So time is a very relative experience, but if you compare to how long you will be dead for millions of years. You're alive just for a few little bit. This time, don't be motivated by anything. All that you have to do is you must become a full-fledged life. 25-year-old boy, he shouldn't become a motivated human being. He must just be burst of life. Then he will not ask, how do I wake up in the morning and be motivated? What are you motivated about? Nothing. If you're alive, you'll bounce out of your bed, isn't it? But now, the way we eat, the way we breathe, the way we do things, and intoxicants and stuff, everything, generally the body wants to die. It doesn't want to be alive. People, you know, it's all from the West. People created this culture, thank God it's Friday. The statistics show that 70% of the Americans hate their jobs, not dislike, hate. 5 days if you do something that you hate, I don't know how you enjoy the weekend. All that happens in the weekend is, you're knocked out. You are either drunk or you're drugged or you're indulging in something, okay? Beyond that, no great shakes, joy is happening, all right? Yes or no? 70% of the people hate their jobs. How do you live like this? Why the hell are you doing something that you hate? First of all, if you don't love doing what you're doing, you shouldn't do it, always somebody will do it. Someone comes to me, he's heading a multinational company, global CEO. He comes in a distressed state and said, Guru, I can't take this. They're putting so much pressure on me every day, can't take this. Then I look at him, raise my hands and say, may you be fired. Oh, Sadhguru, Sadhguru, what are you saying? I said, hey man, you're suffering so much. What is the point? At least if you're fired, you can walk on the beach, huh? Maybe somebody else will do this job little more joyfully than you. You think you're spinning the planet or what? What is the hardship? Are you spinning the planet? Are you pushing it around the sun? Everything is free, isn't it? Everything is free. All you have to do is be a full-fledged life. Don't constipate yourself with too many ideas, philosophies, belief systems, stupid thoughts and emotions with which you get constipated and become less than who you are. No, you should not ever be less than what you can be, isn't it? You don't have to be as good as somebody else, and you can never be, because everybody is different. But you should not be less than what you can be. So you don't need motivation for this, you need aliveness. At 25, if you're not very alive, you need some cranking. So don't motivate your children, it's not necessary. You have to see how they're joyful and alive. In this, their body and their intelligence will work at its best. Oh, will they just be happy and not do anything? You tell me, are you willing to do more when you're happy? Or are you willing to do more when you're unhappy? When you're happy, you're willing to do anything that is needed, isn't it? You're willing to forego your food, your sleep, and do what you need to do when you're very happy, isn't it? When you're unhappy, oh, how hard it is to get anything done from you.